We'll hear arguments next in Ibarra against Illinois. Mr. Goldberg, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready now.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case concerns the validity of a search which occurred at a public tavern in Aurora, Illinois. On March 1, 1976, at about 4:10 in the afternoon, a group of at least 8 or 9 police officers and Illinois Bureau of Investigation agents entered a public establishment by the name of the Aurora Tap, and their purpose was to execute a warrant for the tavern, the premises of the tavern, and the bartender, a man by the name of Greg. Agent Jerome Johnson announced the officers' purpose and authority, and he immediately told everyone in the tavern to stand for a search for weapons. Now, present in the tavern at the time were a group of approximately between 9 and 13 patrons, including my client, Ventura Ibarra. The lighting was sufficient, according to Agent Johnson, for all of these patrons to be seen. And he described the tavern as one large room with one entrance and one exit. Johnson testified he had never seen any of the patrons before. And despite having never seen any of them before, he then proceeded to pat all of them down. He did this even though he testified that he had no knowledge that any had committed an offense, had no indication that Mr. Ibarra had a gun or was hostile or was hiding anything. Mr. Ibarra's hands were visible to him at all times. He had no knowledge that Ibarra owned or worked at the premises, which he did not. He was merely a patron. And he then, in patting down Mr. Ibarra, testified that he felt no weapon at all during that pat down. He felt a cigarette pack with objects in it. That was his testimony. He didn't seize this object immediately. He completed the pat down of the remaining patrons, a task which took several minutes. He then returned to Ibarra, and he searched Ibarra again. And he searched Ibarra again, even though he testified that he had no knowledge at that time that Ibarra had any contraband or any of the items they were looking for. Ibarra hadn't moved between the two searches, and at all times his hands had been on the bar between the two searches. During the second search of Ibarra, the officer found 6 tinfoil packets containing heroin. At the conclusion of the evidence at the hearing on the motion to suppress in Kane County, Illinois, the prosecutor conceded that there was no probable cause for this search. Instead, he relied on a statute, and that is Illinois Revised Statute, Chapter 38, Section 108-9, which says that in executing a warrant, a police officer may reasonably detain to search anyone present at the time of the execution in order to A, protect himself from attack, or B, prevent the disposal or concealment of any of the instruments, articles, or things named in the warrant.
Independent of the statute, Mr. Goldberg, if the officer observed factors which would have warranted a pat-down search under Terry, what would you say then?
If he had observed factors which would warrant a pat-down under Terry, he could have performed it without the authority of the statute. There's a little question about that.
Mr. Goldberg, does your argument depend at all on a question of degree? I notice the Supreme Court of Illinois said, obviously, this warrant to search a department store would not authorize the search of everybody in the department store. Conversely, suppose that a search warrant had issued for explosives stored in a privately owned cabin, and the police were executing a search warrant, say the cabin dimensions were 10 by 12 at night. In it, they found two people. Do you think they would have had the authority to make a pat-down search of those two people?
Well, the answer to that, I think, is that as the premises are smaller and more private and the number of people there are less, then the reasonable suspicion goes greater that they're involved in the criminal activity necessarily. I think this particular set of facts with a public place and 9 to 13 patrons in a place where there is no reason to suspect them of involvement is far beyond any line that might be drawn.
But it is a line-drawing process.
Well, necessarily, a line will have to be drawn somewhere, but that line, I think, is provided in Terry versus Ohio. If the circumstances are such that the officers could reasonably suspect, or in the case of not a weapon search, but a search for contraband, if they had probable cause under the circumstances to believe that the persons were involved in the criminal activity, then they could search them.
If they had probable cause, there's no doubt they could search them. What if they had reasonable suspicion under Terry?
Well, in your explosives hypothetical, of course, that would be a question of probably of danger to the officers. And Terry, of course, is the weapons situation, and reasonable suspicion would be sufficient under those circumstances. If they walk into a place and they have only a hunch that a person might be involved, that wouldn't be enough. And traditionally, of course, when you're talking about searching someone for contraband as opposed to a weapon, the court has always spoken in terms of probable cause. But this distinction which the state seeks to draw, saying that, well, you should only require reasonable suspicion here, I don't think that's one that really has any relevance here, because they had nothing here. They had no reasonable suspicion or probable cause here, whether you consider it as a weapon search or a search for contraband. There was no sort of suspicion at all. Those differing degrees in which there are smaller premises, more reason to believe a person is involved, obviously all present closer questions. But this particular set of facts, there was nothing at all. There was absolutely no suspicion of any kind.
If you were representing the bartender, would you be making the same argument?
Well, the bartender was named in the warrant, Greg, and so I wouldn't be able to make this argument, no.
Well, would you say that if it was found by a state court that there was reasonable suspicion that people in that particular bar might well be armed, could the patrons be patted down just for weapons while they made the search of the before they made the search? Yeah,
if there was reasonable suspicion regarding the persons patted down, then they could be patted down, and there simply wasn't here.
For a weapon.
For a weapon, right.
And then if a weapon were found, and assuming the possession of that weapon concealed on the person was a violation of Illinois law, then there could be a general search.
Right, if they were arrested, if that possession alone gave probable cause to arrest, correct. Now, the particular portion of this Illinois statute that was relied on was not the weapons section. It was not A, to protect themselves from danger. It was B, to prevent the disposal or concealment of any instruments, articles, or things named in the warrant. And it's simply our contention that neither of these searches were performed, neither the first nor the second, with reasonable suspicion or probable cause. There was no articulable standard met at all. The only reason for the search, apparently, was the mere presence of the patrons in the place where the search warrant was being executed. And that's a rationale for search that this court has consistently rejected.
Well, isn't it a little bit broader than that? And I'm not saying it's valid. There is talk here of open and notorious narcotics transactions in this small place. So it's something more than what you've just said, if that's valid.
Well, yes, Your Honor. The first talk of this narcotics dealing being open and notorious is in the Attorney General's brief in this court. That contention has never been made before, and the reason it's never been made before is it's simply untrue. There was no indication that someone who walked into this bar would have been aware that narcotics dealing was going on. The officer testified himself that he had no suspicions that the patrons were involved.
True. Any bar, though, one gets off the plane and there's a bar and he walks in, so I don't see the significance of your comment.
Well, I think the state's assertion is that when, in walking into the bar, the patrons gave up their expectation of privacy. They walked into a bar where they should have known narcotics dealing on, and my assertion is they couldn't have known narcotics dealing on because it wasn't open. If by open they mean that the bartender was standing behind the bar and selling narcotics as openly as he was selling alcohol, that's simply not true.
But you don't challenge the validity of the warrant for the search of the premises,
no,
do you?
No, there was no need for us to.
Well, which said that the reason for searching it was that it was an open and notorious place for exchanging of narcotics.
No, the complaint for search warrant indicated only this. Indicated that an informant had been in the bar the previous day and had seen tinfoil packets the previous day behind the bar and on the person of Greg, the bartender. And he knew that tinfoil packets were a method of packaging heroin, and he had been told that heroin would be for sale on that day, March 1st, 1976, the day on which the warrant was executed. There was nothing in the complaint for search warrant contrary to the state's contention.
Well, what do you say that the searching officer could have searched if he could not have searched the people in the bar?
He could have searched the premises, that is.
Whereabouts on the premises?
He could have searched behind the bar, he could have searched objects on the premises, and he could have searched the bartender, Greg.
Why not the people?
Because the people, by virtue of being there, did not become part of the premises. If that were so, if the people simply by virtue of being there were like became like the bar or any of the objects in the bar, then the warrant would be a general warrant.
What if someone had a market basket they were wheeling out of the bar?
If that was his personal possession, it's not part of the premises. It's his. He has an expectation of privacy in it.
You say it has to be almost a fixture in the real property sense of the word.
Well, it has to be something which the officers could reasonably believe could contain the contraband. And certainly, for example, a case in which beer, a case of beer, which clearly would belong to the bar, although not a fixture, would be amenable to search for the contraband. But an individual walking into the bar where the police don't have any reason to suspect him of involvement in any way, he's not amenable to search simply because there's a search warrant being executed on the premises. In other words, a person isn't part of the premises.
Supposing this warrant authorized a search of the premises and the bartender specifically, supposing the search warrant had authorized a search of everybody in the premises, then I suppose it would be perfectly all right.
No, I think in that instance it would be a general warrant. There's got to be some reason to authorize a search of people in a search warrant.
Supposing, unlike the complaint here, the complaint had said that there was open notorious dealing and that persons in the premises regularly go in and acquire some drugs and so forth and so on, and then the warrant had said all such persons may be searched as well as the bartender and the premises.
Well, if it said, for example, that the patrons, among them Venturi Ibarra, were involved in the criminal activity, I'd have no argument. But if it said that some patrons are involved, or indicated that some patrons were involved and implied that some were not, then I think that there would be a similar, although not as obvious, problem. At least in that instance, there would be some suspicion regarding the group of patrons. But here, there's no suspicion regarding anybody. And I think that's a little more difficult problem where some are suspected and some are not, but that's
nobody
just not
except the bartender.
The only person suspected is the bartender, and it appears from the record that the bartender wasn't even there when the warrant was executed. So I'd like to go back to the complaint for search warrant for just a second, because there is some dispute as to what inferences can be drawn from the complaint. The complaint only indicates that Greg is involved and that tinfoil packets are on the bar. Behind the bar, I should say. And no indication that they're in view of the customers, no indication that the informant saw this as a general patron of the tavern. Presumably he was behind the bar when he saw it. Nothing in the circumstances when the officers entered indicate that narcotics dealing at that point was open and notorious. They had no indication that there was no narcotics dealing going on when they walked in from their position at the doorway. And again,
what about paragraph 4 of the application for the search warrant?
That the informant advised me that over the weekend of 28 and 29 February, he had a conversation with Greg and was advised that Greg would have heroin for sale on Monday, March 1st, 1976. And in my mind, what is the only thing that one can logically infer to that is that this informant or anybody who knew that Greg had heroin for sale could go up to Greg and purchase heroin, but that a lawful patron who walked in to buy a beer would have no way of knowing that narcotic stealing was going on. And I think this will be true anytime there's some illegal activity going on in a public place. Normally, the lawful patrons of that public place are not going to be privy to the information that there's unlawful activity going on there. And unless the police can somehow particularize the reason to believe that a particular individual is involved in the unlawful activity, then they cannot search him merely because they have a warrant for the premises. Now, the state has offered a new rule to justify the search in this case. Their rule is that a pat-down is per se permissible at the scene of a search warrant execution, where officers do not have reason to believe that a person has no connection to the premises or the criminal activity. That's the test set out in their brief. This rule has, I think, several infirmities. First, it violates all the general principles we've been talking about this morning, the rule that mere presence at the scene of suspected criminal activity doesn't lead to an inference that one is involved. Second, again, it would make every warrant into a general warrant. And it would also apparently put the burden on the person to be searched to avoid being searched. He would have to demonstrate to the officers that he was not involved in the criminal activity, that he was not connected with the premises, in order to avoid search, instead of requiring the officers to articulate the reasons why they're searching. And as a result, it could subject virtually anyone to a search on the basis of not of specific knowledge on the part of the police, but because they had no knowledge. Just because they had no knowledge about that person, under the state's test, they could search him. Even if this initial pat-down, this first intrusion in the case, had been permissible, that wasn't the end of it. There was a second search here. Even though the officer testified he hadn't found a weapon, even though all he had felt was what he described as a cigarette pack with objects in it, there was a second search. He explicitly testified that he believed after the first search and before the second search that he had no knowledge that Venturi Ibarra had any contraband. That was his very testimony. He didn't have any knowledge that Venturi Ibarra had contraband. And despite that, he went ahead and searched him again, a second time. And I think the reason why Officer Johnson honestly admitted he had no knowledge is because the feeling through a pat-down of a cigarette pack with objects in it can't logically give one any reasonable suspicion or probable cause.
What is about Greg is that he wasn't there.
The record does not indicate that he was there, and there's no testimony that he was present. And then in the closing argument in the suppression hearing, the argument proceeded on the assumption that he was not present at the time the warrant was executed.
You mean there's a bar without a bartender?
Well, apparently there was another bartender there by the name of Betty Miller, who on whom the warrant was served. But Greg apparently was not there, the person who was dealing narcotics. Now, this second search on the basis of no suspicion or probable cause was improper because the feeling of the cigarette pack with objects in it could not logically lead one to conclude anyone about the person. The officer didn't feel what the objects were. Presumably, they could have been a lighter or a book of matches or any other innocent object, and that's why he honestly testified that he didn't have any knowledge that there was any contraband on Venturi Ibarra at that point. Now, the state also offers an alternative argument in their brief, and that is that the pat-down of all people on the premises when the officers entered was permissible not as a search for weapons but as a search for contraband based on reasonable suspicion. And they engage in some lengthy legal discussion about whether reasonable suspicion or probable cause should apply in a situation like this. And while the decisions of this court would indicate that probable cause is the relevant standard when the search is for contraband, in this case the search would have been impermissible under any standard because there was no suspicion of any kind. The only suspicion offered by the state, again, is their assertion that the narcotics dealing was open and notorious. And as I said earlier, the officer's testimony, the circumstances which confronted the officer and the complaint for search warrant all indicate that there was nothing about the criminal activity on these premises that was open and notorious. There was no reason to believe that a lawful patron would know of the criminal activity.
In your submission, had the search revealed the heroin the first time around, it would be just as unlawful as you contend with respect to the second.
Well, if the officer in patting someone down had found heroin, and of course in patting someone down it would be extremely difficult to find heroin since you're limited to the outer garments. But if the officer had found the heroin on the initial pat down, it would have been equally illegal because that initial pat down was illegal. So that we are arguing that both the initial intrusion was illegal because there was no reasonable suspicion to justify it, and that the second pat down was, the second search was impermissible because there was neither reasonable suspicion nor probable cause.
Well, in the Illinois Appellate Division opinion on page 80 of the appendix, it says, in the first pat-down of the defendant at the bar, a cigarette package with objects in it was felt by the officer. Within a few minutes, the officer again searched the person of the defendant and found six tinfoil packs of heroin. Now, let's pretermit for a minute your argument about the first pat-down being illegal and assume that it was legal. Would you say that the second pat-down was not legal under those circumstances?
I would say so because the feeling of a cigarette pack with objects in it cannot logically give rise to any suspicion that a person has some contraband on his person.
In spite of the search warrant saying this is a place where heroin is frequently bought and sold and that this is a normal way of carrying heroin?
Well, the search warrant doesn't allege that the cigarette pack is a normal way of carrying heroin. I imagine there are a myriad number of containers in which heroin can be carried. But even though the officers knew or had probable cause to believe that there was heroin on the premises, feeling a cigarette package doesn't give one probable cause to believe that person has heroin. Maybe half of the patrons would have a cigarette package in those circumstances. If that were true, then every patient who the officers patted down on whom they felt a cigarette package would then be subject to search.
It doesn't say that they patted him down and felt a cigarette package with cigarettes in it. It says with objects in it. And these objects later turned out to be six tinfoil packs of heroin. Now, it doesn't say they were shaped like cigarettes.
No, but the officer didn't feel those six tinfoil packets of heroin in the initial pat-down. The only thing he could say was that he felt a cigarette package with objects in it. And then he further said that even after feeling that cigarette package with objects in it, he didn't have any knowledge that Ibarra had contraband. So he attached no significance to the feeling of the cigarette pack with objects in it, as far as he knew.
He didn't even know it was a cigarette pack.
Well, I think he indicated at one point in his testimony that he felt nothing, and then later on, in response to a question by the prosecutor, he felt what he thought was a cigarette pack.
And it might not have been.
It might not have been a cigarette package.
Mr. Goldberg, you stress with great emphasis the difference between what you call the first search and the second search. How much time lapsed between the two?
There are variously in the record, it's described as 3 minutes or 10 minutes.
And I suppose the primary concern was for the presence of weapons, wasn't it? Are you faulting him because he may have finished his primary pat-down of all the patrons and then came back to this one, or he should have taken a chance on the presence of weapons in number 10 down the line?
We are faulting him as to both. In other words, the officer had no reason and indicated in his testimony that he had no reason to suspect any of the patrons of criminal activity, and so there was no justification for the initial intrusion, the initial pat-down. And then beyond that, after feeling no weapons and feeling nothing which would give him probable cause to believe that a Venturi Ibarra felt contraband, he went and made a second search. So on both points, we believe the intrusions were improper.
No reason to suspect criminal activity despite the contents of the application for the search warrant.
No reason with respect to the first pat-down to suspect that any of these patrons were involved, by his own admission, by his own testimony.
Well, are not violence and gunplay rather common in narcotics transactions?
I imagine that in narcotics transactions, violence and gunplay may be involved, but...
You imagine?
I accept that it is. And I accept that under circumstances in which search warrants for narcotics are being executed, there may be many circumstances in which the police find it necessary to pat down all the people there. This officer didn't think it was necessary. This officer didn't have any indication that there was any gunplay that was to be involved. There was nothing in the circumstances, by his own admission, that gave him any indication that there was any involvement on the part of the patrons in criminal activity. And he himself admitted he simply didn't think the patrons were involved. So this is, maybe it's a unique situation, but of course I think there'll be many search warrants for public places, and those search warrants cannot by themselves give the police authority to pat down everybody in the public place. If the police have some suspicion, if they have some reason to proceed in that manner, then we'd have no objection to it. But this officer admitted he didn't have any reason to proceed in that manner. And for that reason, we believe both the initial intrusion and then the second search were improper.
Suppose the officer had testified, since we're getting into hypothetical situations, suppose he had testified that he felt a package with some objects in which he thought might be the little packages of heroin, but that he decided to make no issue of it on the first search to see whether the subject would try to pass the heroin on to somebody else and then get to two customers instead of one on possession charges. How would you think that?
That would obviously be a much stronger case for the state if the officer suspected, as a result of the pat down, that the person possessed the narcotics named in the warrant. And of course, that's not the situation that prevails here. But it seems to me that we don't rely alone on the waiting for the second seizure as the reason why it was improper, because there's the additional testimony of the officer that he didn't believe he had any contraband. But certainly that would be a much stronger case.
Is the test a reasonable suspicion or reasonable and actual suspicion?
Well, I think the test for a pat down is a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Well, supposing the officer in this case was just dumb, and he had a reasonable and articulable suspicion, but didn't know it.
It certainly is an objective test. There's no question about that. And if there was an indication in the record that the objective facts somehow were contrary to the officer's conclusions here, we simply wouldn't even be referring to the officer's conclusions.
You're talking about a reasonable suspicion, or however you verbalize it, that about a weapon.
Right, right.
Not about narcotics.
No, about narcotics, we would think probable cause is the standard. But in either event, it's an objective test, but here, obviously, the officer's own conclusions are extremely relevant, just as...
The rationale of this case, as it comes to us, the basis for the decision was on the statute, that if you got a warrant to search the premises, you'd search people on it. Is that right?
That was the conclusion that I think...
It wasn't the rationale that there was a reasonable suspicion of weapons.
No, I believe that the appellate court and the trial court upheld it on the basis of a statute which they, in the manner in which they applied it, must have believed created a per se rule that everybody on premises can be searched. I deserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Well, Mr. Zimroth.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Melbourne Noel. I represent the State of Illinois, appellee in this particular matter.
Excuse me, Mr. Noel.
Illinois submits, Your Honors, that the officers who entered the Aurora Tap with a valid search warrant for the premises on March 1st properly followed the dictates of common police sense in their actions, leading to the discovery of 6 tinfoil packets of heroin on Ventura Ybarra. The state suggests that appellant's criticism of police action here is contrary to common sense. Indeed, I think that perhaps the crucial dispute in this case between both sides is what amounts to a common sense reading of, first of all, the complaint for the search warrant, and then the testimony of the police officer at the suppression hearing. The two sides really do interpret those documents and testimony in a very, very different fashions. We maintain that our interpretation, with its taking the inferences from the logical meaning of these documents, is the correct one. Illinois suggests that if the complete position of the appellant in this case is accepted by this court, then all drug enforcement officers will be less able to lawfully protect themselves from attack in similar situations while they follow orders to execute search warrants that will themselves be rendered more ineffectual.
How could they be attacked after they patted them down?
But one of the issues here, Your Honor...
How could they have been attacked after they patted them down?
They couldn't.
They could not have?
No.
So you don't have any justification for the second search at all, do you?
Well, it's our argument, and we're saying, we're agreeing that they should have been patted down the first time, and then our argument is that the first pat-down of Ventura Ybarra yielded probable cause to believe that he had on him the objects listed in the search warrant.
Could you have patted down a man on coming in the door? And I want to be fair with you. If you answer that that way, I'm going to ask you, could you pat him down on the pavement? And you can't imagine where I'm going from there.
There are circumstances on which a pat-down for weapons, I think, could be justified by a person coming in the door. There would have to be more facts than simply an individual coming in the door. It depends who the person was. You know, was it a nun collecting for a charitable event, or was it a certain type of individual that had other particular factors about him?
Well,
I say it's possible.
Mine did not include a nun. You can have my word.
Thank you, Your Honor. But my point is that it would depend on the character of this individual coming in the door. I think there would be circumstances in which a pat-down would be justified of a person coming in the door. Generally, I would say there would be very few circumstances in which a pat-down would be justified of a person coming in the door during the search. Very few circumstances. But I think they could be imagined.
Well, certainly if it were Greg coming in the door, the pat-down would be indicated.
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. Definitely.
Well, I'm puzzled by your saying very few circumstances, because any stranger walking in the door, say he's just dressed in work clothes like the other people in the bar, why would you treat him any differently than someone already in? He's just another customer.
Well, I think the first thing, Your Honor, is that in most situations, the man probably would not be allowed to walk in the door. I would think probably there would be policemen at the door who would explain to him
But if the question is, assume someone is permitted to walk in, wouldn't he be fungible with the other customers if he just wore the same kind of clothes and everything? I'm kind of surprised you said that it would be very rare that you could pat down him.
Well, perhaps not rare, but I think it would require an articulation of more than we would articulate of the people in the bar.
Well, what do you have about a person in the bar other than the fact that he previously walked in? That's really all you know about him.
Well, he's present around the bar, and he is on the location where the police officers are going to be forced to subject themselves to some risk in order to carry out the search warrant.
But so is the person walking in the door as soon as he gets across the threshold.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. It's true. But all I'm trying to say, maybe I misspoke, Your Honor, in trying to quantify the number of circumstances in which this would have come about. What I'm saying is that I would hope that there would be more things that one could say about the person walking in the door than simply he walked in the door. Hopefully there would be some additional factors about how was he dressed. Did he have on...
But you don't say any of those things about the people who previously walked
in. Yes, we do, Your Honor. The Ventura Ybarra was wearing...
But before he made the initial pat-down.
No, in the initial pat-down, Ventura Ybarra was wearing heavy clothing, which was capable of concealing a weapon. He was standing right next to the bar where the search was going to take place.
March 1st in Chicago, so.
You can reflect on that until 1 o'clock.
Thank
Well, you may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. In further answer to Justice Marshall's and Stephen's question, this obviously is a difficult area because three different courts in Illinois, presented with this type of fact situation, have come up with slightly different conclusions based on the facts of their particular case. Indeed, the same is true of courts in other states. But let me say this.
Reasoning of the court below,
Which, I think it had nothing to do with whether there was a pat-down or not. As far as I could see, the officer could just have come in and searched anybody, pat-down or not, under the statute.
We do defend the reasoning of the court below, which did not rely on a frisk. Mm-hmm. They didn't deal with that, as Your Honor correctly points out. They relied on the second section of the statute, mm-hmm. the reasonable belief that the people in the Aurora tap were involved with the criminal activity and were likely to be concealing the objects of the search on their persons.
And that would certainly distinguish the people who were there from the people who arrived after the search began.
As to that point, yes, yes. The other questions were related to the frisk. As to the search for the narcotics themselves on the persons of the patrons, we defend the decision below on that as an alternative argument. And in doing so, we ask this court to apply the Camara-Terry balancing test to allow this type of a search.
That's a lot of factual, that's some fact-finding in it, hasn't it? Has the fact-finding been done in the courts below?
Well, I think that Your Honor refers to fact-finding with regard to the public interest need and that sort of thing. I think that there are enough opinions written on the general subject. There's enough legislation written on the subject of drug control, and certainly this court has written enough opinions on the subject of the sacredness of the warrant and the desirability of it that I think those interests don't need to be developed any further in order to justify the balancing test that we're talking about. And I think although the appellate court opinion specifically didn't invoke this, I think that in other Illinois court opinions on the same statute, there is reference, the most recent one being People versus Gloria Miller, it was so recent we had to include it in our brief as an appendix. It wasn't published at the time. Now, in that decision, the Illinois Appellate Court First District clearly employs the balancing test and refers to this court's recent decision in Delaware versus Prowse and concludes that a reasonable belief of the connection of the individual to the suspected criminal activity and a belief, reasonable belief, that he's concealing the narcotics on him is required before there can be a search under the Illinois statute.
Even if this court hadn't decided the Terry case as it did, your position, I take it, is that under this statute, all of these steps were appropriate. You draw your authority from the statute independent of Terry.
We don't rely so much on the statute for the frisk, Your Honor, because we don't feel that we have to. If the whole question of frisk goes out the window here and all we're left with is whether or not the search for narcotics on the individual person of Ybarra was proper, then we rely on our statute and we rely on the second section of the statute.
But I'm not suggesting you can't rely on Terry in part, but yes. Primarily you're drawing on the statutory authority here.
Well, Your Honor, we make two completely alternative arguments, and frankly the argument we prefer is the first one, the argument involving a proper frisk of Ybarra, which yields probable cause to believe then that he has the objects of the warrant on him. That's the argument we prefer. Our secondary position is the appellate court position below, which relies on the statute. And we feel that we are entitled to make the first argument. As appellee, I believe that we can rely on any ground which would support the judgment below. And indeed, in this court, in the Cibron decision, indicated that decisions on Fourth Amendment questions is a matter of...
Was this particular ground presented to the court below?
It was not directly presented to the appellate court.
And was never decided?
It was never decided in so many words. The trial judge indicated... Now, which point is Your Honor talking about? The first point.
The
first point. It was never decided specifically. That's
was it
correct.
Presented? Was it ever raised in the state courts anywhere?
It was raised in the testimony and presentation of the agent witness at the suppression hearing and at the trial. It's there in his testimony. It was never argued by the state's attorney either in that court or in the appellate court.
It was never defended. It was never. The state never defended on that ground.
The state never briefed that point. That's correct, Your Honor. But I would maintain that it's inherent in the testimony of the officer. At least four times during the trial court proceedings, he mentioned that the first search of Ybarra was for the purpose of discovering weapons to protect the police officers. So regardless of whether the Illinois courts saw the issue and dealt with it, it was there. And as this court held in Cibron, Decisions of state courts on Fourth Amendment areas based on state law are not binding on this court. The court said in Cibron that this court, in looking at a situation, can determine independently whether or not there was probable cause under the Fourth Amendment or whatever standard is being used. And I would ask this court to do that, and that's the reason we make the first argument.
It seems to me that when the Illinois Appellate Court relied on the second section, it implicitly rejected the first argument, because the first section of the statute talks about justifying to protect themselves from attack, and that's the purpose of the frisk.
I don't think that's accurate, Your Honor, because they simply had never been briefed on the first point, on the frisk point, and they simply didn't address it because it was not raised by the state.
The statute was called to their attention, including both
yes,
sections of it.
Yes, that's correct. But the state's theory in the appellate court was simply on subsection B, the search for narcotics. And the appellate court just doesn't usually address issues that are not briefed specifically before.
But if your frisk theory is valid, you would also be entitled to rely on subsection A, I would think. Because the purpose of a frisk is to protect the officer from attack.
Yes, Your Honor.
Subsection A expressly says that's a permissible.
I would agree, Your Honor. My only feeling is that subsection A is really superfluous in light of Terry. We don't need it. And it wasn't invoked. We just don't feel any point to arguing it. We rely on Terry and on this court's probable cause decisions following that.
How do you, isn't the predicate to relying on Terry some finding that the officer reasonably feared that the suspect was armed?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Well, and is there any fact finding like that in this record?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
Well, how could there? Why was there? But you never relied on Terry. You never presented the Terry ground.
I don't know why they weren't presented, Your Honor. I wish they would.
Well, I know, but if it was never presented, how could any of court have addressed the predicate to Terry if the Terry argument was never made?
Your Honor, the testimony of the agent is quite clear as to what he felt was the danger presented by the patrons in the bar and why he made the first pat-down. The initial pat-down of all the people in the bar is clearly, undeniably, only for one reason. It's a search for weapons. The reason why all the patrons were searched before your bar was searched the second time was strictly because security and protection was more important than anything that might have been raised during the first pat-down of your bar with regard to the objects of the warrant. Then on top of that, you have the background of the complaint for search warrant, specifically setting out, and we disagree totally with opposing counsel's interpretation of this, specifically setting out that over a period of days or weeks, there was open and notorious drug traffic, not usage or possession, but traffic of drugs in this location. The informant who went into the tavern apparently as a patron, at least 10 other occasions, had been there and had observed tinfoil packets on and about the person of the bartender, Greg, in a drawer behind the bar. And then on this particular weekend, of February 28th, 29th, he had seen no fewer than 15 to 25 packets of tinfoil on or about the person of Greg. Now, we submit to you there is no possible logical way to read this other than that these packets, so many packets of tinfoil were there because heroin was being dealt in this location. And we say that as a matter of judicial notice, any court, based on the huge amount of jurisprudence on the subject, can take notice of the fact that where you have dealing in significant quantities of narcotics, there is always a danger of violence. There is always the possibility, and indeed the likelihood, of weapons being found on the individual dealers.
Well, if analytically probable cause will justify a search either for weapons or for contraband, why won't a reasonable suspicion justify a pat-down either for weapons or for contraband? Putting to one side the Terry case.
I would agree that our position would be that both are reasonable, both are good positions, but they would be for different reasons. The pat-down for weapons is based on a different consideration. It is based on the balancing test there. We're primarily concerned, of course, with the protection of the officers. The balancing test to allow a pat-down to discover the narcotics based on reasonable suspicion would have a different cast of characters in the balancing. There you have the interest not being the protection of the police officers, but there you have the interest being the legislatively stated purpose in checking the use of the debilitating use of narcotics in this country and the judicial purpose in exalting and vindicating the effectiveness of search warrants. And so I would say the result, there's no reason why it couldn't be done for both purposes, but the balancing test would have different features in each situation.
Mr. Noel, on the balancing test, no guns were found in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
No weapons of any kind.
That's correct.
So you could be wrong.
But what's required, Your Honor, is not a certainty. In fact, the level...
How many people did you find with dope? In this place?
In this place, there were two separate bags of marijuana found from different people, I believe. There was narcotics paraphernalia.
Where is it in the record?
The only thing we have is the return from the search warrant, which lists the items. Mm-hmm. And we can presume that these came from different people. They could all come from the same person.
Well, it could be. I can't presume things in criminal cases.
Your Honor, we can take reasonable inferences from the facts, I think. But regardless of what was found...
Well, reasonable inference is that a person in a bar has a gun. That's what you said a minute ago.
Your Honor, the statistics...
And you didn't find any guns, did you?
But that does not determine whether or not the officer was capable of having a reasonable belief under Terry before he made the search. We will admit that according to all statistics...
You keep pointing to Terry. What is there in Terry that gives you the right to search for dope?
Nothing. And we maintain the first...
This man was arrested for dope.
But the first search of him, Your Honor, was for weapons.
Wouldn't this be an extension of Terry to apply it to dope?
No, Your Honor. We feel that rather than being an extension or a change of Terry, all that we are asking here is an explanation of the Terry principle and an application to it, or of it, rather, to narcotic search warrant situations, recognizing that general background information...
There was nothing in Terry about dope.
That's right, Your Honor.
This man was casing a joint to rob it.
But Terry has been applied to many other situations than armed robbery. In fact, the most the recent example, which we feel is even less strong in our own case, is Pennsylvania versus Mims. In that situation, all you had was a stop for an individual having an expired license plate. And he's ordered out of the car, and a bulge appears under his coat.
But this man, he didn't have an unexpired license or anything. He was lawfully in a place of business.
That's correct, Your Honor. A place of business in which there was open and notorious narcotics traffic.
That he was lawful. Had it been raided? Had it been padlocked?
The purpose of this...
Had it been closed? Had anything been done to tell anybody that this is a bad place to be in?
Your Honor, that was the purpose of this particular search.
Well, he knows now.
To obtain evidence to do exactly what you're saying.
Now.
But I think, Your Honor, that what we find after the frisk is made has no bearing on whether or not there was reasonable suspicion before the frisk occurred.
May I also take position that the fact you found dope didn't justify the search?
The first search, no, Your Honor. No.
It didn't justify either search in and of itself. The finding of dope didn't justify it, did it?
No, but the...
Did it?
Of course not, Your Honor.
You're not trying?
No. No, we're not trying to go backwards from the finding of dope to justify either one of the searches. So our position then on the frisk simply is what we're asking the court to do is to recognize not only, as Terry did, that certain observed activities on the part of a suspect can lead to reasonable suspicion that he is armed and dangerous. We're asking the court to interpret Terry to allow general knowledge of narcotics traffic and general background knowledge contained in a complaint for search warrant to provide the same kind of basis for a frisk that there was in Terry. And as I was pointing out, in Pennsylvania versus Mims, the only indication that the police officer had in going under the coat of the driver of the automobile once he got him out on the side of the road was that there was a bulge under there. This individual had been engaged in no felonious activity whatsoever. There was no information about him personally at all. Yet the simple fact that he'd been pulled over for a driver's an expired license and had a bulge under his coat, this court found summarily was sufficient basis to justify the frisk. And we would submit that in a much more dangerous situation of police officers executing a judicially ordered search of a place where there had been open and notorious drug traffic, that in that situation they must be allowed, under these circumstances, to at least frisk, they must be allowed to frisk at least the people on the premises to determine whether or not there's any threat to their safety before they go ahead with the search. And that's exactly what we have here. There's no possibility here of a ploy in order to discover dope, Justice Marshall. It is clear from the testimony of the police officer, Agent Johnson, that the initial pat-down was only for the purpose of discovering weapons.
And then when they didn't find any, that was the end of it, wasn't it, under Terry?
Except that during...
And they didn't find any, as you just told my brother Marshall.
That's
they
correct.
Didn't find any, and that was the end of it.
It wasn't the end of it for Ybarra because in the course of the pat-down, they felt, Agent Johnson felt a cigarette pack with
no
objects
weapon.
In it.
No, nothing that he
That's
could
correct.
Possibly
That's
think
correct.
Was a weapon. Is that correct?
But under the lower court decisions which have dealt with this problem, it is held that if they obtain, in the course of the frisk, reasonable cause, if they feel something which gives them probable cause, rather, to believe that the objects of the warrant are in the pocket rather than in a weapon, they are allowed to operate on this. They are not required under the decisions to simply ignore the feeling of the cigarette pack with objects in it and to say, well, it's not a weapon, so we can't touch it. That would be requiring them to give up their own intelligent common sense assessment, which yields probable cause, of what was in the pocket of the individual.
Well, that's true about many provisions of the Constitution, isn't it? Including the Fifth Amendment guarantee against compulsory self-incrimination. The most logical common sense thing to do is to ask a suspect about the, did you do it? And he has an absolute constitutional right to say, I won't answer. That's not very logical or commonsensical, but it is required by the Constitution.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that it's an entirely different quality of right, and it's been treated entirely differently by the courts. I don't think that it reflects on the decisions. For example, the Estelle versus Guzman, the decision of the Fifth Circuit, dealt with this problem, and also a recent decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, United States versus Branch, dealt with this problem. In footnotes, and those courts have both came to the conclusion that when in the course of a proper frisk an officer feels something which gives him probable cause to believe the object of the warrant is there, he is not, should not, and cannot, and is not required to simply ignore it. And so this is the position that we take on the first argument, and we maintain that the justification for the frisk here is as strong as in any of this court's decisions on the subject. And we maintain that under this court's decisions on probable cause, that once the officer, in light of all the background facts, remember there was an awful lot of information available to him from the complaint for the search warrant. Once he had felt this object...
Well, I don't mean to keep going over the same point, but you really, your case depends almost entirely on paragraph 3 of the complaint for a search warrant.
That's correct.
That's the entire basis of your claim that... There was open and notorious drug dealing in this particular location. But if I read it correctly...
Well, in paragraph 4 also, Your Honor, excuse me, in which it's mentioned to the informant that it's going to be offered for sale, apparently at the tavern on March 1st.
That he would have it for sale, presumably,
yes.
to the informant.
So I would say both those paragraphs.
But there isn't a single reference in here to anyone ever having observed a heroin change hands in that tavern.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. But I think the only logical inference to be drawn from the number of packets that are present and from the willingness of Greg on such a short-term basis to have it for sale again from March to February 29th to have it for sale on March 1st, I think it is a reasonable inference to be drawn that this was done before.
Well, it's an equally reasonable inference that the informant could go in on March 1st and get a packet from the bartender.
I wouldn't agree, Your Honor. I don't think that the language here and the background information is that limiting. I don't think it's there at all. I think that would be an unreasonable reading of the information.
See, the informant had been in the tavern on 10 other occasions, but it doesn't say he observed tinfoil on each
yes,
of those occasions.
Yes, it did. Well, I mean, Your Honor, this was not written by legal scholars, but it does say has been on the tavern at least 10 other occasions and has observed tinfoil packets on Greg and in a drawer behind the bar.
Right.
I mean, the only reason for mentioning the 10 other occasions and then following up by the other clause would be to have the one reflect back on the other, as far as I can tell. But admittedly, in both in the search warrant complaint and in the testimony. Everything is not spelled out word for word exactly as we would have liked to have seen it. But it rarely is in search warrant situations.
Well, the Court of Appeals, in its opinion at page 80 of the appendix, says no objection is made to the warrant itself. Now, that leaves open all the questions we've been discussing, but I take it no one challenged the validity of the warrant as far as it went.
That's correct, Your Honor. Throughout the entire proceeding, that's correct.
But they did challenge the right of the warrant to search this man.
That's correct. They did say the position they took was...
The point that's before us.
That's certainly the ruling of the appellate court below, and it's certainly one of the points that's before you, yes. That is not the point which we are arguing first. That's our secondary argument point.
Mr. Noel, just a matter of curiosity, whatever happened to Greg?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Was he ever prosecuted?
I don't know. I never...
He wasn't even present, was he?
We're not sure of that, but the indication is that he was not. But I'm not sure of that either, at least at this point, when the officers went into the bar. Now, on our second alternative argument, basically what we're telling the court, what we're arguing, is that if Johnson did lack full traditional probable cause for a second search, that is, the search which turned up the tinfoil packets of heroin, he at least had a lesser Camara-type probable cause or a Terry reasonable belief that Ybarra and or his fellow patrons were connected with the illegal drug activity on the premises and may have had the objects of the warrant concealed on their persons. These are actually two different possible theories in which the court could affirm the decision below. One of them argued primarily in our brief, the other mentioned in footnote 10 ascribed to Professor Lefebvre. But really, regardless of which theory is used, they're both two parallel ways of describing the same basis for the search, the same information, and reaching the same result. And we believe that the lesser reasonable belief test is more appropriate in this case. That's what we're emphasizing, primarily because a matter of consistency with this court's prior decisions and also trying to create a level of certainty for police officers to operate under. But we think either theory could justify the decision of the appellate court below. And, of course, both theories involve the balancing test, which were used in the Camara, Terry, and other cases that we cite, this court's decisions. We feel that under a balancing test, we feel that we have here such strong governmental interests in the controlling of drug traffic, and very importantly, we're not dealing here with warrantless search entirely. We're dealing with a situation in which officers have been put on the line to execute a search warrant properly obtained from a judicial officer with the full protections of the warrant clause, which this court has so long sought to make sure police officers obey. And in that situation, when there is a problem of feeling that there's a reasonable belief that persons on the premises may have the objects of the warrant and may defeat the warrant by concealing those objects on their persons, we feel that the vindication of the warrant is such a strong interest that it requires the application of the very unusual balancing test which this court has on other occasions employed, on just a few other occasions. And we feel that if that test is applied here, if the court is willing to apply that test, that the only result that is possible reasonably is that a reasonable belief is sufficient for a search of persons on the premises in the type of situation we enumerate here to determine whether or not they are concealing the object of the warrants on their the objects of the warrant on their person. There is no binding authority, governing authority on this argument. The only case really which is brought up by the appellant is the United States versus DeRee. And we feel that that case clearly is not governing, although the language of it may offer some comfort to the appellant. We feel it does not govern the situation for certain obvious reasons. First of all, that was a warrantless search of an automobile. That case was really, it was pre-Terry, pre-Camara, and therefore it never really considered the possibility of a balancing test being appropriate in some situations. And our issue here, our specific issue, was never decided in that case. It was really only alluded to. For the reasons then stated in our brief, we simply ask that the court affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes left, I believe.
Thank you. All I really wish to say at this point is that although counsel for the state constantly refers to the Terry opinion. Nothing in Terry supports an automatic right to frisk in this situation. Terry sets forth a standard of reasonable suspicion, reasonable belief. And the state's position in part one of their brief is that they can frisk automatically when they're executing a warrant without reasonable suspicion. And Terry simply doesn't support that position. And the only other thing I'd say is that, again, the state contends that somewhere in this record there's an indication that drug traffic is open and notorious. I've gone through the factors in the record that I think indicate just the opposite and indicate that the officer's belief was just the opposite. And I could argue till I'm blue in the face that it wasn't open notorious, and the state is really saying nothing anymore than contradicting me. They're not pointing to anything in the record. Any
How about the transcript at page 9 at the bottom of it where it says, what happened during the pat-down, if anything? And Officer Johnson responds, during the pat-down, I felt some objects that I felt to be heroin.
Well, that gets to the other point of whether there was probable cause or reasonable suspicion for the second intrusion. And then at that point, the trial attorney objects, and the court says, basically, you can't tell us what you felt. You have to tell us what facts led you to reach that belief, and he couldn't point
to it. That would at least establish a subjective belief on his part.
Well, at that
point, the test is an objective.
Right. At that point, this is the preliminary hearing. He does seem to indicate a subjective belief. Everywhere else in the record, he says he doesn't have a subjective belief. At this point, which was about a month before the suppression hearing, he seemed to think so. When he reconsidered his testimony later on, he didn't have that subjective belief. And perhaps he'd realized himself how illogical it was to feel a cigarette pack and think that it contains heroin. It was just a hunch. And that also invalidates the second search. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Peyton against New York.